Hello! Konnichiwa! And welcome to the Happy Project Podcast! My name is Becky. Sitting across from me is Cedric Skysetti. And today we have another interesting episode coming your way. How are you, Cooks?
I'm great. I feel better than yesterday.
Yeah.
I was struggling, but today I feel good.
Yeah.
Nice and energized.
You were just tired.
Yeah, I was very tired. And I had a little scare, but
You make this sound really like
no, I mean,
desperate situation.
I pretty much had like a quick little cold or bout with that.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm okay.
But he's fine.
Yeah. I don't know why I made it so dramatic.
It was really dramatic.
I feel good.
Nothing happened, basically. Long story short, nothing happened. That was a good story, though. Thanks for sharing.
You're welcome.
I'm glad you're good. I mean, we see each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real surprises. I just, you know, like to do this to create a little conversation.
Of course. A little small talk.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's bring it back around to our topic, sort of. This is kind of a midway interesting question for you. What do you know about Japan?
What do I know about Japan?
Yeah.
I don't know a heck of a whole lot, to be honest, like in terms of outside of, you know, it's anime's a big thing there.
Big thing.
What else? They're known for sushi.
Did you like anime?
Ramen. No, I didn't.
Growing up, you didn't?
No, I the only thing I ever watched was Sailor Moon. When I was a kid. What?
I'm sorry. I already knew that, but it just caught me off guard again. I just can't believe you liked Sailor Moon to the point where you can publicly announce it with this confidence.
I'm okay, because that was like 30 years ago.
Wait, which was your favorite Sailor Scout?
Probably Sailor Moon. Because like she was the blonde. She's the cute one. Oh. And then I like Venus, too.
Venus. Well, yeah, because Venus was also blonde. I see that you've got a type here.
Was Venus blonde? I thought she was brunette.
No, dark-haired. Venus had like long gold flowing
locks.
It's
been very long.
Don't lie. I know that you have posters of the Sailor Scouts and you every night you say, in the name of the moon.
Oh my gosh.
I've seen you do it.
Oh my gosh. Okay, yeah.
You brought
confessional.
It up.
No, but that was the only, I guess, anime that I ever watched. And that was it. I had friends growing up that were into anime and stuff like that. Like, of course, I was half Korean, so I was a little bit more familiar with like what was going on in Korea as a kid. But like, I think for everyone who was into like any sort of Asian culture, it was always Japanese culture growing up.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really remember anyone being into K-pop or Korean stuff.
Or dramas or anything like that?
At all when I was growing up.
No. So, I mean, besides that, some of the food, I know that, you know, there's a certain, I guess in the cities, like in Tokyo, there's this work culture that's quite crazy. Similar to Korea, I think, but I think it might even be more intense. I mean, outside of that, I don't know. I mean, I visited for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was in Tokyo just by myself, eating, taking photos, running around. And that's it. That's essentially it. I mean, I don't know too much outside of that.
Do you want to hear something really sweet and wholesome?
Yeah.
About your beloved Sailor Moon.
Mm-hmm.
So the
did you hear anything I just said, or you just think it's Sailor Moon? Sailor Moon.
So the creator of Sailor Moon, she created these because she was during a period of her life where she was very sad and depressed. So she just started drawing stories about these girls that she wished she could be friends with. Isn't that so sweet? Look at that.
Cute.
Yeah. And in a way, they kind of came to life and became a lot of people's friends.
Yeah, she's probably rich, too.
Including a young, half Korean, half black boy growing up in the States. Became friends with the Sailor Scouts. But I heard everything that you said. I was paying attention. Well, today we're going to talk about Japan in a way. We're going to focus primarily on something a little bit more niched. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are a lot of people who have not heard about what we're going to talk about today. And it makes a lot of sense why that would be, especially if you are not familiar whatsoever with Korea or Japan or the history. And even if you are Korean, you might not be fully aware of the history or plight of some of these people. And if you're in Japan, you also might have heard of it, but maybe it's not really publicly talked about. I'm not really sure what's taught in schools about this. But it'll be very interesting to see what research further crops up after this episode, because I found this great book that was talking about this, the stories of these people. And the more you read, the more becomes illuminated, but I think it's not very clear from the very front what it's like. But anyway, okay, I'm being extremely vague. You guys will know what I'm talking about in just 1 second, and that 1 second is right now. So we're going to talk about a people group in Japan called the Zainichi, or this is a term that is used to describe these people. You could also say they're ethnic Koreans in Japan, and it's a very particular group. It's not just any Korean that has come to Japan to live here, like right. Today, for example, would not technically be called Zainichi. Or you're also called Joseonjin. Joseonjin might be more familiar, I think, to people who speak Korean. But the Zainichi, for our purposes, we'll call them Zainichi, and these are the Korean Japanese. So we want to talk about this particular group. And in order to really understand who they are, we got to go through the history. What led for a group of ethnic Koreans to find their way in Japan and then now be categorized under a very specific term, as opposed to just being Korean Japanese, right?
Right.
So the Zainichi. Now, I guess first and foremost, we should mention that at the time where the Zainichi were really getting public attention, I think, or it was being is more notable, right? This is at a time where governments around the world, but particularly in Japan and in Korea, and were using ethnic homogeneity to unite their citizens, to create a united front against foreign enemies. First country that comes to mind would be Nazi Germany, right? Using this concept of ethnic homogeneity or purity to justify control. So this was kind of the backdrop upon which the Zainichi first generation of these Japanese Koreans start to really appear. And because of this particular mindset or political concept for control, because of that, the plight of the Zainichi was so exacerbated, right? Did that all make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
You know, and you pretty much explain what the word Zainichi means, but to just to sort of add to that, it does mean that they are ethnic Koreans living in Japan. Zainichi, the word itself, means living in Japan. Mm-hmm. But from my understanding, that term can be taken as sort of a negative.
Right.
Right? So it's not like a compliment necessarily to be called Zainichi, but I know a lot of Zainichi refer to themselves as that mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, I wonder if I could sort of relate to that in that even though it's different, it's sort of like in Korea how you're a foreigner, meaning you're an outside country person, but you could be living in Korea mm-hmm. and still be called a foreigner. Mm-mm-mm. You can even have long-term residency and called a foreigner. And some people don't mind it.
You can even get citizenship.
Right.
And still be classified as foreigner.
Right, exactly. So yes. So I feel like just like the word foreigner can carry different sorts of nuances, I think Zainichi is similar in that, but I think it goes even deeper
yes.
than foreigner for sure.
Yeah. Hey, that was really nice.
Yeah, I was just thinking because I was like, I wonder why, because they call themselves that Mm-mm-mm. or they refer to themselves as that, but also it can be taken offensively. So mm-hmm. I think it just depends on the context Mm-mm-mm. in which it's used.
I think you're right. So you're right. Zainichi, technically the term means living in Japan. What it indicates is that these are temporary people. The term itself gives this feeling of strangers here. You're not really Japanese. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the nuance that the term is carrying, these Zainichi Koreans. So it's used to describe these long-term ethnic Korean residents. They are permanent residents in Japan, but some of them have not acquired Japanese citizenship. I think now today, more have acquired this Japanese citizenship, but prior to more modern times, it was kind of a special status given right. to these long-term ethnic Koreans right. living here in Japan, right? And they're considered the largest group of quote-unquote foreign residents in Japan. So the Zainichi.
Yes. So who are they? The Zainichi, they are essentially just descendants of Koreans who settled in Japan as migrants during the Japanese occupation, which took place starting in 1910 officially, all the way to 1945 is when it ended. Mm-hmm. And so why did they migrate to Japan? I mean, there are several different reasons. Some were conscripted laborers during World War II.
Yeah.
So as the Japanese citizens were in war, they needed a labor force.
Right,
so
in
they
Japan.
Essentially drafted these Koreans.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of post-World War II refugees, they fled to Japan.
That's right.
Right.
Let's give a little bit of context here. I know I just kind of jotted some notes down, but for some people who are not aware, 1910 through 1945 was a very oppressive Japanese rule in Korea, on the country itself. And so some people came to Japan either to study or to work rather menial labor jobs, mm-hmm. Because in some way either they were forced or it might have even been a better life than what was in Korea at the time. And then, of course, during World War II, we had some people conscripted, as we know what was going on with World War II. And then after World War II, it is important to understand Korea's status at that time. This is what, 1945, mm-hmm. right? Even up through the 50s, Korea was in a very oppressive, still kind of regime, quote unquote democratic, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of anti-democratic things happening from the government standpoint. And a big one was in Jeju-do. The Jeju Massacre happened in 1948. So the residents of Jeju were opposing the division of Korea. And Lee Seung-man, who was president at that time, he violently put down the uprising. And so mm-hmm. thousands of these people were killed. And many of those thousands also who survived fled to Japan, because Jeju is pretty close to Japan. And so this is also where a number of ethnic Koreans are coming from during this time where there was, you know, some violent anti-democratic things happening on the government standpoint in Korea.
Right.
Okay. So this is where people typically are either fleeing from some situation or forced by a colonial rule into a situation. So this is the backdrop that's happening. Okay, so I guess to go into the brief history, we'll look at a timeline then, right? From then to now. So I found out something. So starting from 1910, it noted there were several thousand Koreans who were living in Japan at this time, mostly students, the merchants, the workers, some people who came during, I guess it was called the Meiji Revolution, or the Meiji, is it revolution? Anyway, Renaissance, something that was happening. This was way back in 1860s. And so there were still a number of Koreans living in Japan during that time. But 1910, this is where a lot more were coming. And then 1920s, you know, seeking education, employment opportunities, and they were migrating to Japan to fulfill a shortage of labor. Again, a lot of these Koreans were poorly educated or illiterate. And so they were working in the lower stratum. So in Japan at that time, they still had, you know, the empire. Mm-hmm. And so there were, you could call it classes. And classes. And so the Korean migrants at that time were on the lowest stratum. So in Japanese society, they were on the very bottom rung. To give an example of just how difficult and discriminated the life was for these Koreans, in 1923, there was the Great Kanto Earthquake. And during this time, the Koreans were scapegoated mm-hmm. for some reason or another. And there were actual public huntings of Koreans. So it's kind of think of it as public killing, similar to lynchings.
Right.
This was happening across Japan. So that history exists. The 1930s, finally, ethnic Koreans were recognized as a social group. They had lower wages than everybody else. And they also lived in ghettos because of poverty and discrimination. So mm-hmm. actually, if you visit Japan, I read up that most cities in Japan have at least one Korean ghetto.
Oh, really?
I don't know what it is today. Like, has it been torn down and it's just marked as a historical monument or something? I'm not really sure what it looks like, but it seems that most cities had one or another.
Right.
Do you want to take on the next?
Yeah, sure. So from about 1939 to 1945, there were approximately 700 to 800,000 Koreans that were brought over as laborers. Mm-hmm. And that number peaked in 1945 at 2 million.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big number of Koreans compared to, you know, obviously other ethnic groups in Japan at the time. And during World War II, some Koreans achieved successful careers in business or in the military, and they didn't want to leave their privileged status to, say, go back to Korea, especially at that time, because, again, this is where Korea was very poor. And so, you know, they're like, we made our life here. We're good. You know? Yeah. So I think a lot of them just sort of stayed there. During that time, because, you know, they had their life, they had their way of living, and there was no point in going back.
Yeah, I mean, there would be many reasons why you not to return. One is, you know, you sacrificed, say, 1910 to 1945, like a number of years in your life during this very turmoil period, but to establish a life, that's a lot of time. And so they established their life in Japan. And so some people could not afford to return back to Korea. Some people went to Korea and was like, whoa, I just built my own life in Japan all these years to return to the motherland. And here it is a devastated country. I don't want to start over again.
Right.
Some people by this time had married Japanese people or had half Japanese children. And so this was another big reason why a lot of these ethnic Koreans stayed in Japan.
Right.
So something to kind of... I guess I was trying to understand like where the lines here, the country lines, you know, who's national, who's citizenship, et cetera, because it gets a little bit fuzzy with Korea because during the Japanese occupation in Korea, Korea was colonized by Japan from what, 1910, 1945. So I read that those Koreans were considered as Japanese nationals if they were in Japan, because it was almost like Japanese people coming to Japan. I'm not really sure how that worked, but it seemed that they had that citizenship to be called Japanese nationals during that time. But the end of World War II, we know Korea's nationality status became quite ambiguous. It wasn't recognized. There was no recognized functional government on the Korean Peninsula, North or South. So the split happened, but there was no, you know, technically, legally recognized government country status on either side. So these Koreans, these people who were quote unquote Korean citizenship now abroad in Japan, suddenly didn't have, like, what were they? Were they Koreans? Were they Japanese? They didn't have a nationality. So they were eventually registered under, just temporarily, under the name of Joseon. And Joseon was the old name of undivided Korea before it became North and South. So they were just Joseon, like Joseon people. Right.
Right. But in 1948, the Declaration of Independence between the South and North Korea made Joseon extinct.
Yeah.
So, so it's just like now it's like, what are we?
Yes.
You know,
totally stateless.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to imagine what it feels like to be in that, you know, position where you're sort of, you're definitely not in your own land, but you're, you know, your homeland is not familiar anymore and you don't have a status. You don't have sort of... really an identity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it must have been a very trying time during that period.
I'm imagining too, like, because there would have been Koreans who had come from the northern end of the peninsula. So they came to Japan when North Korea was still part of Joseon, but then they cannot return back to North Korea because North Korea was not actively recognized as a legal country.
Right.
So then, I mean, you're totally stuck and you don't want to return to South Korea. You don't have family there. Or maybe you also have communist ideals. And so you wouldn't feel right going to South Korea, which was, quote unquote, the enemy of your people. Right. So it's a very complicated thing. And we'll see how these political ideals play a significant part in how the Zainichi community worked in Japan. But let's go back to... After the Declaration of Independence, right? So Joseon now does not exist.
Right,
so they're not Joseon people either.
So you had mentioned earlier that the ethnic Koreans in Japan were recognized as Japanese nationals prior to 1945. But after World War II, they were labeled as foreigners.
Yes.
And at that point, they were labeled as Zainichi.
Zainichi, temporary residents. Right. After the end of the war... it said that the number was about 620,000 Koreans stayed in Japan. They're the ones who did not return back to Korea for one reason or the other. And it seems that the number has not really fluctuated from what I read. So about 620,000 Koreans. So, I mean, it's not a huge number, but it's quite significant still. But starting after World War II, things just kind of went downhill for the Zainichi. In 1945, they lost their voting rights in Japan and in Korea. Then employment policies would exclude these ethnic Koreans from quote unquote Japanese jobs. So mm-hmm. teachers and lawyers, government officials, they didn't have a voice. They had no place to say. In 1947, there was the alien registration law, which made them officially aliens. And then in 1950, the nationality law stripped the Zainichi children with Japanese mothers of their Japanese nationality. So if your mom was Japanese, then you could not have Japanese citizenship.
Right.
If your father was Japanese, then you could.
Right.
It is this, you know, this patriarchal kind of society. And from what I know, I actually think that still exists in Korea, I think. Mm-hmm. I'll have to double check that. But there's definitely been cases, especially with the Kopino children, the Korean-Filipino kids, trying to get their citizenship, but their mom is Filipino. So I'm not entirely sure where that rule stands here in Korea, but in Japan at the time, 1950, this is when it happened. They were these half Korean, half... Again, it's funny, they call it Zainichi. It is still different from Hafu. Hafu and Zainichi,
mm-hmm.
different. Even though you would still think in English half-half.
Right.
But they are half Zainichi children. And yeah, if their dad was Japanese, then they could keep their citizenship, their Japanese citizenship. But in 1952, due to the San Francisco Peace Treaty, this ended their right to Japanese citizenship. Because in order to take up Japanese citizenship, they had to abandon Korean citizenship to be naturalized as Japanese citizens. But what that meant to the Japanese government is that you had to give up your Korean name. You had to pick a Japanese name. You couldn't be on the Korean family registry. You had to be now on a Japanese family registry. And these, it was essentially a way for them to, they had to give up their ethnicity, their culture, their claim on being Korean in all forms in order to become a Japanese citizenship. And this is where things come head to head, which we are still seeing in Korea today. The concept of your ethnicity equaling your nationality,
right.
your citizenship. And so this Zainichi faced this and it came head to head.
Right.
Right. So ethnic Koreans were, you would have to make quite a difficult choice if you wanted to live a life of decent standing in Japan, but you would have to give up something that is so innately you. So this was kind of the issue that was happening. So of course, as we know, since ethnic Koreans were then excluded from many rights that were given to even non-nationals, so naturally they had to pursue different kind of works because they had to survive somehow.
Right. So, I mean, you know, they would take on just, I guess, labor that was considered to be on the, you know, the mm-hmm. the lowest part of the totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
And even sometimes...
You're in the highest part of the totem pole.
What's that?
Don't you remember I told you totem pole? When you're on the lowest totem pole,
mm-hmm.
traditionally, that's actually the most valuable or prized position.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was the master carver. He was the one who was carving the bottom part of the totem pole.
Oh.
So the phrase should be flipped. You're on the top of the totem pole if you're actually lowest on the stratum.
Okay, well, then they're at the top of the totem pole. Yeah. Which is not a good thing, to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, in addition to doing this type of work, I think a lot of them also got into illegal activities,
yes.
which included producing alcohol, mm-hmm. scrap recycling, and racketeering.
Yeah. Oh, you know, also, you know the pachinko? You know pachinko rooms?
Mm-mm.
In Japan, do you know when you walk past those arcade parlors and the noise is just so
yes.
insane and everyone is just like playing the
yes.
game? And in a way, it looks like a gambling parlor.
Mm-hmm.
Because they kind of were gambling parlors, these pachinkos. And so pachinko has a very like Russian sound to me. You know, it's pachinko. But it's a pachinko, those parlors. And so a lot of Koreans, Zainichi actually ran these pachinko parlors. And they had ties with the Yakuza and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So as you can see, in order to make a living and, you know, survive in the society, they had to go to things that were not, quote unquote, legal. Right?
Right. Which is understandable. So, again, as you mentioned, the Japanese government, what they wanted was for the Koreans to just give up anything and everything Korean
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, look, you could survive here. You just need to be basically Japanese.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this, we'll touch on this a little bit later, but it brings into that question, what does it mean to be Japanese? And that's a question we ask on the Happy Project a lot. What does it mean to be Korean?
Mm-hmm.
Because in order to earn your Japanese citizenship, you had to be quote unquote Japanese. But what did that mean?
Right.
So at that time, it meant giving up your name. It meant giving up your identity, your cultural identity, your family history. in order to be quote unquote Japanese, right? But we'll talk about that in a bit. So as you can see, during all this time, even up to very modern years, and even still to today, Zainichi faced a lot of discrimination. So the Zainichi, think about the things they suffered, the colonial suffering, the historical suffering, the discrimination that was still happening in modern day. Why then would you willingly give up your cultural and your ethnic identity in order to be part of this society and community that has put you down for so long and hurt you so much? It's a very, you know, like knife point place to be at. Mm-hmm. Can go one side, can go the other. And so this is where the Zainichi were then. And so now it's important to recognize, because I feel like we're simultaneously showing what's happening in Japan and Korea in order to understand what's going on. But we know in Korea at this time, it was split now into South Korea and North Korea. And the split was not so much geographical, but ideological, mm-hmm. right? So we have communist North Korea, and then we have, quote unquote, democratic South Korea at this time. The Zainichi, the people who are living in Japan, were sort of forced to choose one side or the other. So during this time, the Zainichi were needing help. They needed help, and so they would get help from their own people. And so they established these two organizations, two factions of Zainichi, which still exist to today. And we had the Jongnyeon and the Mindan. The Jongnyeon, they were established on the ideals from North Korea. Just because you were from North Korea and came to Japan doesn't necessarily mean you're a Jongnyeon group, but the Jongnyeon group itself is on based on the North Korean ideals. So this organization was being formed, and the Mindan was also being formed, and they are more what you would equate with South Korean ideals. And these two organizations that were happening in Japan, at first they did very good things for the Zainichi, giving them a voice, giving them a place to gather, having sports events, activities, opening schools for the ethnic Korean children to get educated.
Right.
So they were, of course, you know, doing right by their people. But it is notable that Zainichi then were sort of forced to choose between one or the other. Am I going to be this North Korean Zainichi, which was called the Joseon-seki, or am I going to be the South Korean Zainichi, which was the Gangokuseki, or am I going to give up my Korean ethnicity to become Japanese citizen, in which case you were called Nihonseki, which meant traitor. So even right. within themselves, this you're being forced to choose between these three rigid, you know, this rigid system. You're forced to pick one of the three. So that was going on right. as well. Stop me if I'm talking too much.
No. It's fine. It's fine. It's very interesting. And so at this time, what you see is the Zainichi, they start to become more isolated.
Mm.
They start to shun intermarriage.
As in, don't want to marry Japanese.
Japanese, right. And then also they start to resist nationalization, becoming Japanese or becoming like the Japanese and, you know, just stripping away everything that they knew.
Yeah, I mean, why? Like, I see it now. I would also, mm-hmm. at that time, it would be very, like, the word is 억울하다, like, very resentful and pushing, oppressive. Why, in order to become a people group with you who have made my people suffer so much, why do I have to give up my identity to become one of you?
Right.
Like, if you put it in very, you know, rough, callous terms. But I imagine that there's a lot of emotion involved.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So as foreigners, as they are, even though many of them were at this point born in Japan,
mm-hmm.
They were excluded, again, from just being able to get a lot of different employment opportunities in different categories. They couldn't vote, and they suffered a lot of negative attitudes
mm-hmm.
Within the Japanese society, which tended to denigrate its Korean minority and culture.
Yeah. But it's not only just in Japan that this was happening. So in the 1950s and 1960s, the Jongnyeon, you know, the Jongnyeon organization, they were trying to basically help the Zainichi return to North Korea if they wanted to return to North Korea. So Jongnyeon, this organization, actually, they kind of have become the unofficial embassy of North Korea and Japan. So it's to that much power that they had. And so they helped return many, many Zainichi to North Korea. And even this is how some Japanese nationals are living in North Korea to today, because they would go together with their Korean spouse and they would immigrate to North Korea. But even returning to North Korea, or if they would try to return to South Korea, the people there now at this point, this is maybe second gen, is looking at them with suspicion. you know, oh, you are a spy, or you're not really Korean, you know? And so where is he supposed to go? It's this very in-between world that was happening. And over time, naturally, many Zainichi Koreans today do not speak the Korean language, maybe don't know Korean culture very well. And so there is discrimination that exists, not just in Japan, but also in Korea. I think now, maybe, hopefully, there's more understanding and education, but especially back then, there was a lot of discrimination against Zainichi, even from Koreans who are living in Korea.
Right.
And you can imagine that mixed Zainichi also suffered double this discrimination that was happening from all sides. So it was very, very, very difficult time. Let's jump up into the 1980s.
So until the 1980s, the Zainichi faced barriers receiving medical, their pension, and other safety nets and public services. And it must be noted that at this point, they were also paying taxes, but they weren't able to access any of the benefits of, say, other nationals. And so in the 1970s, new social movements and intellectual currents encouraged assertion of a Zainichi identity.
Yeah. I mean, at this time, the people are now coming to like, you should be proud of your Korean identity.
Right. In the 1970s, there were new social movements and intellectual currents that encouraged the assertion of a Zainichi identity.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, hey, be proud of being Zainichi, right? Mm-hmm. So this sort of new awakening, if you will.
Yeah.
For example, Koreans led an anti-fingerprinting movement and a real name initiative that asserted the ethnicity of naturalized Koreans.
So here, I know we keep saying Korean, but it should be emphasized these are Zainichi Korean.
Right.
Right, Zainichi Korean specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah, but did you know, up to this point, even up to like the 80s, the Zainichi Koreans were required to have all 10 fingers fingerprinted, which was basically what criminals had to do in order to keep, quote unquote, keep track of them.
Right.
So it was very denigrating to have that done. And then, yeah, the real name initiative, the reason why is because, like we mentioned before, having to give up your Korean name or change your name, take a fake name because you were scared of getting caught out to be a Zainichi.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so now we're in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And so now we're starting to see sort of a shift.
Yeah.
So in 1985... there was a revision of Japan's nationality laws, which eliminated the patrilineal descent of citizenship.
Yeah.
So this meant that half Zainichi children with Japanese mothers could receive Japanese citizenship too. So it doesn't have to just be the dads anymore.
Yeah. I found this statement so interesting. I know I mentioned it earlier, mentioning like hafu.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like hafu and half Zainichi is... the way I see it is that hafu is this big category. Zainichi is under that category of hafu.
Right.
But it's if you're pointing out specifically, oh, you are half Zainichi, right? But again, think about it like today, if you see half Korean, half Japanese girl, you would call her, oh, hafu, it's a hafu girl, right?
Right.
But if she was specifically of the Zainichi community, of those three categories we mentioned earlier, right, who had come to Japan during that specific time, even though ethnically you're Korean, you would not be Korean Japanese, you'd be Zainichi Japanese. So I found that to be very interesting.
Right. So in 1987, it became possible now for naturalized Koreans to keep their ethnic names. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have to toss it. They didn't have to take on just the Japanese
names.
But
still many did. Because even though the law changes, doesn't necessarily mean the social attitudes change.
Right, right. I mean, it might be easier if you want to just be a part of Japanese society and the function to let that go. And so now we're in the 90s. By 1991, permanent residency status was granted to almost the entire Zainichi population.
Yeah, so you're not forced now. You're not forced to choose one or the other. You could still be Korean, but you would have permanent residency.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So legislation and regulations were amended to reflect this new status, including allowing them to work in previously inaccessible employment categories, such as teaching in schools.
Yeah, that's pretty significant.
Yeah.
I mean, all of these are very significant, of course, but I feel like it's something different to seeing somebody who is previously what society looked down upon now in these positions of responsibility
and respect.
Yeah. It really changes the way that you would view somebody.
Sure.
So I'd say the 90s was pretty big as well.
Right. And now you come to the turn of the century, right? And South Korean celebrities and third-gen Zainichi are openly and proudly announcing their Korean heritage.
Yeah.
So you go from really just this negative sentiment towards Zainichi to in the 2000s, people are proud. They're like, look, I'm Korean.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it.
It took 50 years to do that.
Yeah.
So crazy to think about that. Isn't that weird? I mean, half Korean, Hunyar is pretty similar situation.
Sure.
If you think about the timeline. Today, now, we openly say like, oh yeah, I'm Hunyar, right? I don't have to pass as one or the other or have to live overseas in order to have a decent life. You can state I'm Hunyar and people aren't going to immediately look down upon you, hopefully. And you can see that, but it was only 20 years ago, 30 years ago, maybe the 90s even, where it was really, like, really wild, bad, looked down upon. There was biases. Same with Zainichi in the time. And so it's very interesting to see how it takes so long time for society to change their view on who is worthy of having a value or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So many Zainichi today consider naturalization as a matter of individual choice, and they embrace the possibility of a Korean-Japanese identity.
Yes.
Which is cool. I like that.
That middle ground.
Yeah.
That previously before could not exist. It was very hard to accept, you know, oh, your ethnicity has to equate to your citizenship or vice versa. But now this is where the Zainichi are very interesting and to me rather key players in representing this possibility of no, your identity and your citizenship and your ethnicity is actually a bit fluid. And you're not forced to pick one or the other, forced to pick Joseon or Kankoku or, you know, Nihon. You can be Korean. You can also be Japanese without betraying who you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one more thing to note is until recently, resident Koreans in Japan, former colonial subjects and their offspring, had only two options for staying in Japan. Naturalization, which required, of course, assimilation into society and the adoption of a Japanese identification, or Zainichi status, which meant remaining Korean nationals and keeping their own ethnic identity. Yeah. So now there's a little bit more fluidity.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, that was quite a, not a brief history. I feel like we went pretty well into that. I just wanted to briefly touch then upon keeping culture alive. We had, you know, we have talked before about how culture is taught and, culture is very significant in keeping like, a connection and understanding of yourself and your identity, especially when it comes to race, ethnicity, communities, your history. Culture is very, very vital. So then how did the Zainichi keep their culture alive in Japan, which, you know, from historically speaking, Japanese, let's say more imperial Japan, was very oppressive against Korean culture, right?
Right.
So at the time, and, you know, some might argue even to today, the Japanese government wanted to be monocultural, monolinguistic. So Koreans, the Zainichi, if they wanted to keep their language alive and the culture, they had to put their kids in private Korean schools. And until rather recently, these schools were not recognized and they had no funding from the Japanese government. I still think today there's no funding. And many of these Korean language schools are run by the Jongnyeon organization. If you remember the Jongnyeon, they are the ones with the North Korean affiliation. I think you were watching a video earlier. It was even in the 2000s, as late as what, 2019? How late? What year was it? Do you remember?
It was, I believe, just a couple years ago.
It was basically, it's the anti-Korean league in Japan,
right,
where they're anti-Zainichi,
right,
and so they went to these schools to protest, and, you know, they're just being horrible. So you can see that still there are victims of intolerance and prejudice here and there. I guess you would even call it homeland if you're born in Japan, you're second gen in Japan, but ethnically you're Korean and you maintain this Korean lineage and culture. So it's a very difficult thing to look at when you consider the history and past of many Zainichi. So these schools, there's I think about 140 still, but they are rather dwindling, especially because of their affiliation with the Jongnyeon organization. Unless it's openly stated, most people just assume, oh, if you're Zainichi, you're with Mindan, right? A lot of those schools teach a strong pro-North Korean ideology and allegiance to Kim Il-sung, you know, Kim Jong-un and all of that. And under Japanese law, they are not really classified as regular schools. Even these schools were initially funded by the North Korean government.
Right, which I did not get. I was like, how did that?
How? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know either. Yeah.
Yeah.
But very militant, I would say, those schools are. Mindan also has some schools, and those ones are more embraced, I would say, by Japanese school curriculums and the education organizations in Japan. So, yeah, interesting that there's actual specific schools separately for Zainichi, but now more and more the Zainichi are, while maintaining pride in their cultural identity, I hope, have also started going to, let's say, Japanese schools or taking Japanese citizenship. But still, it's not considered, quote unquote, traitor.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a bit ambiguous today. You know, what's this difference? What does it mean to be Korean? What does it mean to be Japanese? What does it mean to be Zainichi? So it's very important to look back at the history in order to fully understand I don't even want to say like the sentiment or the feeling or the wellspring or whatever it is that roots the first gen, second gen of Zainichi to still feel strongly as Zainichi and not Korean, not Japanese, right? Okay, well, we won't touch on 종년 or 민단 anymore. You guys can look them up yourself. I think you'll be interested to see how these Korean ideologies were at war even within a different country. And it was the Zainichi people, I think, who suffered the most with that. So what does this mean then? This is what I wanted to touch the most upon. What does this mean, this evolution of new Zainichi identity? To me, I think I feel that the Zainichi are rather a very significant player in these societies that prior to were claimed to be homogenous.
Mm-hmm.
Now it is inevitable that these societies are becoming multicultural, Japan, Korea especially, and the Zainichi have been constantly there, always insisting on or hoping to have this multicultural identity, being fully this and fully that.
Right.
And I feel that, you know, as Zainichi Koreans are becoming integrated with mainstream Japanese society, while still keeping pride in their heritage and their culture and their, you know, maybe grandmother's language, perhaps this will help maybe soften the way for other people who are now coming to Japan, other hafu, people who are born in Japan but may not look quote unquote Japanese, and be able to find welcoming in both their sense of identities.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. I feel like this is also something that helps to separate what it means to be a national or a quote unquote citizen and separates the ethnicity, right? Because like, and you see this in Korea, of course, like it's very hard in the minds of a lot of Koreans in general to just separate ethnicity from nationality, understandably, right?
Yeah.
And so I think now there's a little bit more room to be able to say, hey, I can be half Japanese, I can be half Korean or half anything else, but still be Japanese. Maybe I was born here or maybe I was even naturalized, but I could still be Japanese and partake in all of the benefits of being in Japan, and you know, I can work, I can vote, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of it being a black or white, well, you're not ethnically Japan, so you can't be considered Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's starting to challenge what it means to be Japanese or what it means to be, you know, just whatever ethnic identity you hold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I you know, and I'm hoping that you know, the same thing would happen in Korea as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like Korea and Japan are very similar in that.
Mm-hmm,
in that, you know, there's not a super strong distinction between ethnicity and nationality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this sort of homogenous monocultural pride.
Right.
Right. Yeah, no doubt it's uncomfortable. No doubt talking about these terrible things that happen even in the modern day, purely on your ethnicity, purely on your difference of name or look or language, the fact that that kind of discrimination exists is so tragic, especially when simultaneously those people may feel, but I belong here. This should be my home country. I should be part of the Japanese community. Why don't you accept me, while being pushed away by those people? It is a very painful thing to consider. And I think that if we can learn from this past, if we can learn from these mistakes that have been done and these long-term racist biases against people, we can learn from that in the past so it doesn't repeat today, as we see what is happening in some other countries around the world. And yeah, if we can learn from that, then, you know, we won't have a repeat of this history of discrimination. Right.
I like it.
I just wanted to read this one last quote. This is from the book Sainichi, Korean Women in Japan. This is a very interesting book that I started reading. I haven't finished it yet, but I highly recommend you check it out by Jackie J. Kim Wachutka. And she quotes Kang Sang-jung, who's a scholar in Japan and part of the Sainichi community. And he says, "Why don't the Zainichi just disappear, assimilated into Japanese community? Cynical views may arise, claiming that the Zainichi are like bubbles of history that ought to disappear, and their descendants will eventually erase the trace of foreigner and be incorporated into part of Japanese history. But is it really so? Because they're minorities? Because they're powerless? To a member of the second generation like myself, I cannot help but think that the testimonies of the first generation represent a portion of my own history, a narration of history that is my flesh and blood. This is because they are my father and my mother. For me, what is spoken here is not a substitute for a historical record. The stories are part of my flesh and part of my bone, from which I cannot tear myself away." Which are great words. Yes. And I think wrapped it up pretty well.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting, and I certainly learned so much about.
Yeah,
yeah, just about. I guess you could say Japan.
Did you know?
Another aspect.
Did you know about the Zainichi?
I did not. No.
Before, right?
No. So before you even brought this topic up, and I think it was maybe a few weeks ago you mentioned it. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had met one guy who was. Zainichi, Korean. I don't know if he called himself Zainichi at the time, but I learned later on, oh, you are second gen or third gen. That was a very interesting realization. That was the first time I ever came across the idea that, oh, there are communities of fully ethnic Koreans living in Japan. And so since then, I thought about it. Then I thought it was suitable for the podcast, because I'm sure we have some people out there who are either part Zainichi or Hafu who have encountered these groups or part of this community. And I'm wondering what you guys think too. So that being said, I wonder what you think. It's time for listener mail.
Ooh.
All right. Well, we have, we got a long one here, but I don't think I can read through the whole thing, but we'll just, you know, we'll give it a chance with the time that we have. So this is from Cynthia. She says, "Hi, everyone. Just wanted to write a huge thank you to Creating the Haffy Project. It is such an honor and relief to hear people's stories and experiences that are so similar to my own. Navigating this world as mixed has been super confusing and sometimes just downright annoying. But listening to your stories and stories from other people, I feel more at ease knowing that I'm not alone." And she said, "Watching your episode about the importance of learning culture." So she explains, "My mother is Malaysian Chinese, ethnically Chinese, but third generation Malaysian national, and my father is white from Australia. I looked more white purely because my skin has pink undertones, but I always struggled to make friends with white people due to cultural differences. So in order to fit in within white society, I felt I had to strip myself of any type of cultural background or language differences." And she says, "When she was younger, I couldn't speak Mandarin at all and hardly had any motivation to even learn it," which I honestly think happens a lot with a lot of mixed kids. "Recently started learning it again and actually found it very useful in understanding my identity and cultural context," which we nail home all the time, mm-hmm. the value of language in understanding culture. "I used to feel very confused because people would often assume that I am from mainland China when they hear that I'm half Chinese. While learning Mandarin, though, I found that there were a variety of words that we can use to make identifying myself easier." Oh, this is very good. For example, for Chinese people from mainland China, we call 中国人, and the literal translation of this is a person from China, the country. But I found that there was a much better word to use when you are an ethnically Chinese person from outside mainland China. This word is 华人, and it is usually preceded with your nationality. After learning this, I felt more secure in being able to call myself half Chinese because I realized that it was just the English language failing to understand the complex Chinese identity. There are also other confusions that can happen, but it's all just a bit too complicated to write in one email." That is a very key point. Really, really fascinating. And I've also felt this to be the same thing in English. When I was trying to come up with a name for Haffy Project, I was like, half Korean project, half white project. Like, what do you say? I didn't want to eliminate people, but in Korean, just 혼혈, right? Mixed blood, I guess. So having a pool of words to choose from to identify yourself. I can't read out this whole email, Cynthia, because of time. But thank you so much for writing this. This is very, very, very valuable. And she mentions a book that she's reading where the author is discussing her relationship with her identity. And but this author calls it an overcrowded identity. It meant that she knew exactly who she was, but her explanation of her identity changed depending on what she knew about the other person. My question is, do you feel like you have an overcrowded identity as well? If so, how do you deal with it? That's a great question, Cynthia. And you know what? We'll leave it here and we'll address this in a future episode. So stay tuned. And in the meanwhile...
Yeah, because I was going to unload him like, we don't have enough time.
We don't have enough time for this, Cynthia. This is such a great email. Yeah, let's address this in a future episode. So okay. Stay tuned if you want to hear our answer to Cynthia's email. But in the meanwhile, if you have anything you'd like to ask us or you'd like to say, or you are part of this I Need To community, we hope to hear from you. You can get in touch at thehaffyproject@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe and like wherever you're listening to your podcasts. And we'll see you next time. We are The Haffy Project.